I wanted to talk tonight, so Rick Hansen and June 26th, 2013, about a very common and deceptively simple, but really profound moment in our lives, which is when we feel impatient, all right? Impatience. And so having come back recently from Manhattan, at the land of impatience, I thought it would be appropriate. You know, about a New York minute, right? It's like that, but anyway. So, and I'll tell you a little story about myself. So I got back, and the day I got back, I went for a little walk with my wife. This was yesterday, so it's very fresh in my mind. And she was telling me a situation that was bothering her, and I'll spare you some of the gory details, which of course you'd love to hear, but I'm not going to tell you, but anyway, so protect all of our confidentialities. But anyway, so she was bothered by a certain situation that she's been bothered about in the past, and I'm getting increasingly bothered that she's bothered, and it's not about me, it's just sort of like I feel a little bit, in that term from psychotherapy, like a witness at the execution. You know, present in a situation, someone you love who's grappling with something that's hard that you can't do anything about. And sometimes, and it's a fine line, sometimes all we can do is bear witness. And there's something profoundly important about bearing witness. On the other hand, sometimes it feels a little bit like just the bearing of witness is somehow enabling or perpetuating or in some sense sanctioning the situation and the kind of helplessness and inertness around it. So, and it's a fine line, isn't it? But I just want to name that distinction right there. In any case, I started feeling impatient. Now, you could look at it, as the Buddha did, in terms of what are the factors, processes and causes. What was my process of impatience? It was a long day. My flight had been delayed. You know, it was at the end of it all. It was a familiar situation. But in that moment, I got impatient and moved into solution mode. Okay? She was hadn't seen her husband for a few days. We were traveling together, but we'd been apart for a few days. She was bothered, in pain, worried, just wanted to share. We've probably all been in that moment too, where one person is in relationship mode or process mode or empathy mode, and the other person is in fix-it mode. Okay? Now, as gender goes, as you probably have noticed, and many studies have pointed out, it's typically women who are more in that process mode, men classically in that fix-it mode. In my own marriage, actually often it's the reverse to some extent. But still, I think probably more often than not, I'm going to be the fix-it person. And so that's, again, another factor, another log on the fire of causes, as it were. What are the causes of the processes? We always kind of look at those in Buddhist practice. So in any case, I got impatient and moved into solution mode. My wife was not happy about that. Felt wounded and somehow judged and lack of rapport. And her hopes for an interaction that had some sense of rapport and joining in it were thwarted by my own impatience. And I didn't get what I wanted either, because the whole thing ground to a halt. So looking back on it, drawing on the Buddha's criteria for right speech, wise speech, right speech, you may know that there are five that are sort of mandatory criteria, and the sixth is desirable, albeit optional. The criteria are, and I looked at my own speech, I got 4 out of 5, okay, of the mandatory ones. It was well-intended. It was true what I was saying. Inherently, it was useful because, you know, the take I had, I think, was useful. She would agree to that. My tone was clean. It was fairly neutral. It wasn't harsh. So I got the 4, right? Which one did I blow?
Timely.
Timely. Exactly. It wasn't timely, nor was it wanted. That's the optional one. But, you know, it's ideal. It's desirable, but I definitely flunked wanted. And I flunked timeliness. Why? Because I was impatient. Now, think about something that you're impatient about. You keep it to yourself, you don't have to tell anybody. But something where you're you're pushing to get something to happen, or you're in an interaction with someone and they do this thing, whatever it might be, they're just kind of slow about it, or they are telling a story and you just want them to get to the point, okay? Whatever it is, think about a recurring impatience in your life. One of my favorites is, you know, you're in a public space and the event occurs, then it's over. People are streaming out of the auditorium. There are a couple of double doors, and then a couple of people stand in the middle of the doorway talking with their new best friend. Everybody else is trying to get out. That's one of my personals. Okay. Like, I don't stand in the doorway. I'm like impatient that they're standing in the doorway. Okay? So think about something you're bringing it down to earth. And it's really in these very homely moments that you can see the whole of the Dharma. So make it real for yourself if you can. Think about something where, now there's some close cousins to impatience, irritability. Do you ever get irritable? Irritability or disappointment, right? Or frustration. So you're looking closely at them. So now to contextualize this, the first is I want to talk about this kind of important teaching in Buddhism called, it's often titled, The Destruction of the Taints. That's how it was originally translated, the taints. Taints are like stains. Something is tainted if it's contaminated, if it has something bad in it. There's a lot of early translation of Buddha Dharma that has a fairly shaming or righteous or heavy on the superego, you know, hold the salt languaging. More recent translations of these taints, so-called, use other words like the flows or the effluvia, right? And the three fundamental flows that lead to suffering in this particular teaching are the flows of desire, sense desire, the flows of becoming, or the taints of becoming, I'll get back to that one, and the flows or taints of ignorance. Now, the Buddha grew up in a rural, agrarian, farmer culture, very agricultural. Many of his metaphors, and he talked to regular people in the monastics, or they grew up in that culture as well. I mean, the wealthy people were farmers. He came from a farming family. Okay. And so in that context, the effluvia, as it were these irrigation flows that were used to irrigate the crops. But if you had the wrong kind of flows in the wrong place, you would ruin the crop, right? So there's this sense of what are the flows, and then how can we halt them so they don't cause problems for us? So you can imagine the flow of desiring this or that and getting into trouble as a result. That seems pretty straightforward. You can imagine also the flow of ignorance. Like, why is ignorance a problem? In Buddhism, it's the root of suffering fundamentally. It's not seeing things as they truly are. It's not seeing things as endlessly fluid and interdependently arising and insubstantial as experiences, and therefore never a reliable basis for happiness. It's not seeing that with every cell in your body. That's ignorance. Okay? And then becoming. What is becoming about? Becoming is very much about, in modern psychological language, expectations. It's about the ongoing process that poignantly is deeply wired into the architecture of our nervous system to anticipate something and then measure what actually happens against this anticipated image or sensation. And related to that, there's an expectation of reward if what we anticipate occurs and comes true. And then if we don't get the expected reward, that's uncomfortable. We feel frustrated and disappointed, which fires up drives, and then impatience, and then at the end of a long trip, your moment of rapprochement with your mate, you blow it because you're impatient.
Man, you must have really blown it.
I'm a shrink. I really mind these things, you know. I didn't blow it too badly, but she was not happy. It was ill-timed. Yep, it was major ill-timed. So, yeah.
I understand everything you said, but I'm still not sure I agree. Is it really impatience? Is that really what happened? I mean, because you can say you were tired, you had good intentions, so I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'm using impatience. It's a great question, of course. I'm using impatience as a window into the fine print, because this is where it happens, in where the rubber meets the road in the moment. We're balanced, and then we tip. What makes us tip? And the tipping, for people particularly like you all, who've been doing this for a while, the tipping can be quite subtle, right? It's not like we're tipping into, doing something terrible to somebody, or, you know, blowing all our money on a night in Vegas, right? Or life savings. We're not, well, I'm hearing some laughter. Is there something I should know? But we don't usually tip that way. This is where we tip. We tip here, you know? And so what I mean by impatience, I mean, first of all, that sense of agitation we get into, where we're not centered, we're edgy, we're irritable, we're annoyed, we're frustrated, or we want something to happen that's not happening. You know? You know that feeling? Where I think of it as a little bit the red zone. Maybe for me it was more pink, or I don't know, somewhere between pink and bright red. For my wife, when I went into my pink zone, she went into the red zone. So, you know. So what causes that? What causes it? Very often, it's this very natural process in the brain. So I want to talk about in your brain and my brain. There's an expectation of reward if I get what I want, right? If I could just get her to see the light about the right way to solve this problem, so she no longer has this problem that she's telling me about, and I'm getting upset about hearing yet again, because I love her and I get bothered when she's bothered. See? I don't want to be bothered. So I want to solve my problem of being bothered, getting her to stop being bothered by solving her problem the right way. Now. Isn't that life? I'm doing it in my marriage. We could talk about work. We could talk about it politically. We could talk about it in our neighborhood, the barking dog. We get impatient. We get edgy, right? Now, the Buddha has something to say about patience. See, because impatience is the opposite of patience. And you may know that in the 10 characteristics, the paramis, some early Buddhism, there were 6, and the list grew. Now it's basically 10. The 10 perfections of a bodhisattva, or the 10 perfections, the paramis or perfections, of someone who's really far along. And the interesting thing about these words, these 10 qualities, I know Linda's taught them here, some of them at least, is that we are engaged in a process of perfecting them. It's an ongoing process. So what is the perfection of patience? And why would he add something so homespun, so seemingly mundane, really, to the 10 attributes of a completely enlightened person? He says here, and this is traditional language, so kind of bear with some of the scriptural tone here. He says, the perfection of patience should be considered. Patience is the unimpeded weapon of the good in the development of noble qualities. For it dispels anger, the opposite of all such qualities. All right? I formed an expectation. I anticipated a reward in my mind if I could have my expectation fulfilled. Right? Then when that expectation was thwarted, that was uncomfortable, right? Which moved me to irritability and anger. Patience is the adornment of those capable of vanquishing the foe, the strength of monastics and noble beings, a stream of water extinguishing the fire of anger, the basis for acquiring a good reputation, a mantra for quelling the poisonous speech of evil people, a mantra being a personal inner reflection, the supreme source of constancy in those established in restraint. Patience is an ocean on account of its depth, a shore bounding the great ocean of hatred, a panel closing off the door to the plain of misery, a staircase ascending to the worlds of the gods and Brahmas, the ground for the habitation of all noble qualities and the supreme purification of body, speech, and mind. That's pretty flowery, isn't it? But on the other hand, for me at least, actually, after I did a retreat a while ago, there were two or three words I wanted to focus on for a year. And for me, one of those three words was patience. Because patience is this quality to allow things to be other than what we desire without losing our cool or suffering. Right? The Buddha, talking to his son, Rahula, gave him some advice. He said to Rahula, who was about 10 or 14 when his dad, the Buddha, was laying this trip on him. Okay. Imagine that one for a minute here. Anyway, he said, meditate so that your mind is like the earth. Things get thrown upon it, slops, feces, leaves and twigs, and the earth does not reject them, or be harmed by them, or be horrified by them. Patience gives us that evenness. You know, it's not that we choose the slops or the feces or whatever, we do what we can to manage them, but we are able to stand things not being the way we want them to be, including in the little moment where we have an expectation, and instead of shutting up and nodding sincerely, empathically, and benignly, you put your foot in it when you're talking to your wife after you come home from a trip, right? Patience is what lets us stay steady. It's a doorway into deep, deep equanimity. And it's something very near and close to us that we can actually practice routinely. Okay. So I want to say another little thing here and then go practical. Okay? Okay so far? So you see this very interesting connection. Here we are, right? You're talking with someone, you're a little irritable, you're a little frazzled, you're a little fried, you're frustrated. You know, making matters worse, you're right. They should get out of that doorway on the way out of that hall. You know, they shouldn't just keep circling the drain, as it were, in their repetitive involvement with this, recurring problem. You're right. Make it worse, right? You know the right way. And you're not getting with the program. All right? See, let's make it really real, right? And you know you're right. But guess what? It's not timely. The force is not with you, right? It's not the moment. The causes and conditions are not there. Now, I want a quick sidebar. We can make a mistake the other way in not being timely. We can let something go and go and go when we should have spoken up about it long before. You know, as a sidebar, I just saw the movie on the road, 42. About Jackie Robinson, first African American baseball player in the kind of standard major leagues, and Harrison Ford does this amazing job playing Branch Rickey, the white manager who brought him up, and clearly you can see in a very telling scene where Harrison Ford playing Branch Rickey basically says with some remorse and shame that he feels bad about not speaking up before now. Good that he spoke up in 1947. Bad that he didn't speak up before then, and many, many other people as well, obviously. So that's a big example of waiting too long, but timeliness also means, you know, not waiting too long and not losing our nerve and being cowed and frightened. I came across another recent, this daily email I get of the Dharma, and there were three words in there, the advice of the Buddha, to be peaceable, friendly, and fearless. Isn't that great? I just love that combination. I can remember that. You know, three words. I can remember three things. Peaceable, friendly, and fearless. Peaceable. It's a nice word. Friendly and fearless. Isn't that cool? Right there. You're not agitated. Peaceable, friendly, and fearless. So another little thing that came into me yesterday. This is, again, an admonition from the Buddha. Let one guard oneself against irritability in speech. Let one be controlled in speech. Abandoning verbal misconduct, let one practice good conduct in speech. So irritability is another kind of impatience. Okay, what to do about it? Any questions so far in the analysis, right? We want something, it's not happening, right? The expectation of reward occurs, the reality of reward drops, dopamine levels drop in the brain, and then we feel disappointed, frustrated. We want to make something happen. Okay. We will patiently wait for Julie to turn on the lights. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was great. Okay, yeah, in the back.
I get very impatient when things don't work.
Yeah. You mean like physical things or?
Just, you know, the iron isn't getting hot enough fast enough.
Yeah.
You know, the sewing machine needle, I can't put the thread through the needle. I can't see it. You know, it's like one thing after another. And I just realized as I'm speaking that it's because I have so little time. I always feel like I have so little time.
Yeah.
You know, and I have a list that I make every night before I even get up of the things that I have to do. And, you know, it gets worse. And
yeah.
It makes me want to go to become a nun.
Yeah.
Honestly. When I come here, it makes me feel so peaceful.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and it's like, oh my gosh, there aren't so many things to do.
No, it's really true. Well, thank you for saying that. And I'm thinking of the Buddha's line, you know, talking about the monastic life. And he, of course, was a fan of the monastic life. He was a monastic himself for 50 years. He taught for 45 years, and he practiced as a monastic for 6 or 7 before that. So. He said household life was dusty. He said household life was dusty. There's just too much stuff, too many to-dos, too many entanglements. It's a big matter, isn't it? And with regard to the one thing you brought up here, I think about my own drivenness to get things done as an odd kind of craving or addiction. And I think it's the craving of the West to get, the craving of the West?
Yeah,
to get things done, to accomplish, to complete. And we get agitated when we feel slowed down in getting things done. And for me, so how do we practice with that? I think there's like a macro and a micro way to practice with it. The macro way is to be careful what you load into your to-do list, you know? And I had a conversation with my wife while traveling with her, because I do intend to actually make a significant shift in my life. And I realized that the increment that would make a big difference for me is about 20%. But it's real. I need to load a fifth fewer items into the front end of my hopper. Because what comes out the tail end is all this to-dos, or all these overhead, is all these consequences. And that goes to a kind of renunciation. I have to give up, in my own case, at least a fifth of the cool things I want to do to have a really cooler, saner life altogether. And I think that's where wisdom is. You know, as the Buddha taught again and again, wisdom is giving up a lesser happiness for a greater one. To give up the lesser happiness of packing our daily to-do list, you know, and the anticipated reward, the expected rewards of getting all those things done, for the greater happiness of a simpler, more peaceful, less packed lifestyle. And I think that's where we just have to look at things really hard. Sometimes we're committed to stuff. I am. Where we just have to, as we said in the psychedelic days, you ate it, you ride it. You know, speaking from some experience here. And so I've thrown a lot of commitments. I'm going to honor my commitments in my hopper. We typically have thrown commitments. We honor them for a while, but be careful, you know, where the choice is not throwing that next cool thing into your hopper or just watching it. You know, I had a little moment with my wife recently where I was thinking about my next book, right? And I said, well, you know, if I want a book out to come out annually, I need to go through this process of, you know, actually I need to start getting my proposal together now. And I was talking out loud, and she knows I'm already at the upper limit of my capacities as it is. And she just stared at me in horror. She was like, are you insane? And in the moment, you know what? I was. I was deluded, either poison or taint or the flow of ignorance, you know? I was ignorant about the consequences of throwing that commitment in, which I was getting ready to call the publisher, you know, et cetera, start the ball rolling, and man. So that's one thing at the macro level. That's not the whole of how to have householder life be peaceful, but I think that's a big one for a lot of us. All these commitments, whatever it is, we're gonna remodel the bathroom, you know, we're gonna plan this neat vacation. We've got to save at this rate. We're going to do this thing with our kids. They're all good, usually, you know? And then we throw them in the hopper, and the next thing we know, we're working 12, 14-hour days, and we still have 2 to 3 more hours in any given day we could spend zeroing out the list, the items on our
You haven't meditated.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They have a saying about counterfeit money. The bad money crowds out the good. You know, all the little, you know, C priorities start crowding out the A priorities. You know, as the old saying has it, instead, put the big rocks in your bucket first. You know, have you, I realized for myself that, you know, my well-being boils down to, you know, basically 3 fundamental factors, meditation, exercise, and study. Those are the big rocks, you know, and in that, obviously, love and love. Those big 4 factors with my friends and my family and all. So that's one. At the micro level, this is where impatience really comes in. You can watch the sense of compulsion. Know what compulsion feels like. You know? Just like that, whatever it is, the rat that has to keep pushing the lever to get its little injection of cocaine. Or those people in the slot machines in Vegas, you know, right? Or people in sales or around food, I gotta have it, or whatever that thing is. Watch that sense of compulsion. I felt in that moment with my wife, walking through Terra Linda, 8 o'clock at night, it was a beautiful evening. We love each other. Our daughter was gonna be 23 years old the next day, you know? And guess what? In that moment, I was as hooked as that rat pushing that lever to get that shot of cocaine. I had to say it. We know that moment, don't we? Don't we know that moment where we feel compelled? So at the micro level, watch compulsion and then resist the compulsion. For example, do you really need to fill out that checklist? Or maybe just say, I'm only going to make sure I do 2 things tomorrow, or 3 or 1 or something, right? Or I'm going to work hard, but like people in a factory, I'm going to clock out at 8 o'clock. That's a trick I've played for myself. I said, no matter what happens, I'm going to work hard, I'm going to work honorably. At X time, I'm clocked out, punched out. I don't know if you've ever done factory work with a time card I have, and you know, I'm going to clock out. So that's, I think, an important one too. Here's another one. When we're caught in the expectation, the biological machinery is very well designed to keep rats chasing cheese. Okay? So if you wonder about yourself, the next time you're feeling impatience, rats chasing cheese, as mechanical as that. Mother Nature wants us to chase that cheese. What can we do about it? Well, what's happening in the brain, dopamine levels are dropping because our expectations are being thwarted. That creates a kind of zeroing in, what in psychology is called a focus on the demand characteristics of the situation. Our whole world comes down to this position we're going to get across, right? Or this item we're going to zero out on our to-do list. This email we're going to finish, even though it's our kid's birthday dinner. I'll be there in a minute. You know, that sense of compulsion. The dishes we feel we have to do. I had a client who could not leave a dish in the sink. I teased her at one point, how about taking a clean, her sink was like surgical. You could do surgery in her sink at the end of every round of dishes. I said, how about a single grain of rice, clean, dry rice? Just put it there. Could you stand it? Nope, couldn't stand it. That's compulsion, Okay? So when you're in the moment, see if you can pull your awareness up and out of whatever it is you're feeling impatient about. Like when I'm walking out of the theater, right, and those two people are yakking it up and they're having so much fun, and the happier they look, the more I want to smack them, you know, and all the rest of that, right? So, right? My mind is zeroed in. It's like total tunnel vision. Open. What was that phrase I used at the beginning? Expand to include, you know, at the beginning of the sitting today. So open out. Then we're not so locked into the demand characteristics, and we don't feel so demanded upon. Because when we feel demanded upon, we're unfree. Buddhism is about freedom. So that's a second practice, you know, to try to go big. You know, see the big picture. I'll say one more thing, then maybe I'll take your comment again. And by the way, because I was on the East Coast yesterday morning, I'm going to end really close to 8:30. So the other thing I want to say about it that I've been thinking about in terms of the neuromachinery, what's going on in the neuropsychology of it all. In the moment of dopamine levels dropping, because the sensor reward is dropping, that's really quite uncomfortable. Now, one way to deal with it is just to tolerate rewards dropping. That's a pretty hardcore monastic practice. A friend of mine, one of the Spirit Rock Teachers Council teachers, Temple Smith, great teacher, very, very great teacher. He described his time as a monastic, as a monk, and he said they would go out on alms round. You know, it's a lot cozier for me. I just talk, you put, you know, stuff in the bowl, it's a good gig. You know, those guys had to get up at like 5 in the morning, barefoot, cold, and they had to walk, and it was all freezing, you know. And so he went back to the abbot, because he was like this Westerner, you know, softy, and said, do you realize that we don't have shoes on? And the abbot said, just notice unpleasant. Then he sent him off. Great, thanks. Notice unpleasant, including the unpleasant of the reward that we anticipate and we're impatient about not getting, not arriving. Right then, they had to change their route and their alms round, and they had to walk for hundreds of feet on gravel. Cold feet in the morning on gravel. Temple really didn't like that at all. So he goes back to the abbot. He says, well, noble sir, you know we're having to walk on gravel now. The abbot looked at him and said, notice unpleasant. Send him on his way. All right, so there's a place for noticing unpleasant. There's a place for that. In addition, what we can do when this narrow disappointment, this narrow thing that we're impatient about, this frustration, right, is happening, we can, besides opening wide and kind of pulling back out of the sense of being demanded upon, we can notice what else is actually rewarding in this moment. Right? We can notice that in this moment, your wife loves you and you love her. We can notice that in this moment, we're still breathing. We can notice in this moment, there are physical pleasures, often in the body. We can look around. There's beauty. It was a beautiful evening yesterday. In retrospect, I'm thinking to myself standing here, what was I thinking? You know, look around, the sun was setting, where I live were nice hills nearby, you know, the air was great, you know, it had been raining, it was misty, it was, like, I could notice all those other reward opportunities, and that would then tend to help my brain register that there are other rewards, and not be so agitated and compelled and driven, mouse chasing cheese, you know, by the one thing that wasn't going right. That's another very powerful thing we can do. Okay. Couple comments or questions, and then we'll move on. Oh, it was about looking for other rewards. If there's a sense of, because if you think, why are we impatient? It's because we're not getting a reward we want. You know, or we're programmed, or we expect, usually because we expect it in the moment, right? And a way out of that, besides just tolerating what's unpleasant, and there's a place for that for sure, is to be aware of other rewards, you know? Like, literally, if I were doing it, like, that's an amazing red shirt. It is. It's a super rewarding color, and I'm feeling really rewarded by it. And then, you know what I mean? You can just do a little thing, and suddenly you're not so robotically compelled. You're not unfree. If we're feeling unfree, boom, wrong dharma. Right there in a nutshell. Yeah.
I was noticing something in common with your impatience with your wife and your impatience with the people standing in the doorway, which is that you wanted to control them. And I wonder if that could be an alarm sounding in your head, oh my goodness, I'm trying to control these people.
Yeah.
I better try and do something else.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I want to draw a distinction. I've thought about this a lot. You know, when is controlling others an end in itself versus when is it a means to an end? Right? Now, sometimes, I admit it, I do experience a sense of reward in feeling powerful, controlling, if you will, influencing. Like I can get them to do what I want, whatever that is. I admit that, okay? We're social animals, I really admit that. And I think there's a different category where I want something to happen. That's what I really care about. And them doing X or Y, including getting out of the doorway or showing up on time, is a means to the end of me getting what I want. It's not that my goal per se in that instance is to control people. It's that getting them to do what I want, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it's to a different end. So I have found that distinction actually pretty helpful, you know. And I think that's worth paying attention to. Either one is problematic, you know what I mean? As you point out correctly.
So, yes, either one will cause
trouble.
Somebody not to respond well.
Yeah. And then, of course, the art is how to be willing to exercise wholesome influence over others. As the Buddha himself, obviously, he was very direct with people. He laid down a monastic code that people had to maintain if they wanted to participate in the community, the monastics, and things like that. The Eightfold Path is a very influential path. So it's an art, you know. Influencing other people is not inherently a problem, but as you, I think, are getting at, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what are the fruits? What results from that? And what should we appropriately be cautious about? And I think the more power that we have, the more authority we have, the more mojo we have, the smarter we are, you know, the more we're privileged by our class or our skin or our gender, whatever, the more careful I think we need to be about influencing others in passing. So I appreciate what you're saying. Maybe another person or two, and then I'm going to honor my body.
Well, I've noticed something, another thing that works for me in terms of the pulling back.
Yeah.
I'm really close to my mom, and I also work with her. So when she gets triggered, it's easy for me to get impatient if it's an old thing.
Yeah.
And I noticed that what helps me get the perspective that you were talking about is I'll remind myself she won't always be sitting here.
Yeah.
And it dramatically just changes my love and acceptance for whatever's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Great. That's a great method. The big picture view. Great. How about you? And then a couple more, and that's that. It's a huge question, and I think what I'd like to do, if it's okay, is take it up next week. And, you know, I have a notion that Buddhist assertiveness is not an oxymoron. In other words, it really is possible to be centered and not compelled or caught, and also engaged in the world. So how about I duck for the moment? I will say that for me, the inner dashboard, you know, you probably have an inner dashboard, right? If it's red, it's not the time. Once in a while, if it's red, you got to do what you got to do. But if your inner dashboard is red, including just a background sense of irritability or frustration, it's probably not the right time. I think sometimes it's necessary. You know, the burning, the building is burning, you're screaming at everybody, get out, get out, get out. Okay, you're red. What are you going to do? Just stop and recenter. The building, you know, goes up in smoke, so you could really not have you got to do. But most of the time, I think, if you feel internally, like in that moment with my wife, you know, it's in these moments that we're in the little, we're in yellow or red. You know, it's easy to notice it if we're just enraged, right? Or we're just panicked. But it's these little moments that all this crap goes down. So that would just say that, okay? But I'm going to pick this up next time. Okay, great.
I think this whole thing with to-do lists, it is so culturally based, just like you said, because when you travel abroad, you go to Latin America, South America, things are just so different, and there's a whole connection and relationships. And of course, I have my to-do list. I have a steno pad I fill it up every morning, personal, and then one at work. And I'm kind of learning to not get so frustrated if I don't go checking off everything. But an interesting idea I heard just last Sunday from a spiritual teacher was to make a to-be list.
All right.
It was so interesting. So now I'm, I don't know if it's going to work, but I'm going to try it. You know, to be more patient with my mother when she repeats the same thing, given that she's 91 years old, the same thing in 10 minutes. To be more flexible when my husband asks me about some computer program that I've already explained to him how to do three times. So just, you know, having a few things, and maybe not every day, but just maybe, you know, a couple of things that I'm working on for that week.
That's great. Love it.
Have a to-be list.
That's great. I think that's... That's a book, you know. Put that on your to-do list. Write a book. Good. All right. The to-be. That's good. All right, good. Last.
What I've noticed in situations that you've described is that it's one of the root causes is the inability to absorb the pain that the other person is suffering. That the suffering of the other person.
Thank you.
You want to fix it. It's... The impatience comes from, the reason you want to fix it is you can't absorb it.
That's right.
And, I mean, I've experienced this, like, in much more serious situations where somebody says they're very ill, and I don't, you know, and it's a life-threatening kind of thing, and I have no idea what to say, and so I say something stupid because I can't absorb the pain that... It's caused in the other person, it does them no good. It may even be true, but it's totally untimely. So, you know, the other way out of that is to just say, oh my God, I think that is so, you be empathetic to the other person that of their suffering rather than try and solve the problem.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much for that. Somehow I was just thinking of the earth when you were talking, you know, the Buddha's advice to Rahula. To staying there with it, you know. And that was true for me. I wasn't there with what my wife was feeling. And you're right, it was agitating me. Right. Well, so how about we just sit for a minute here, and in the week ahead, if you want, you may have at least a few opportunities where impatience, disappointment, or frustration might arise, you know, and plenty of opportunity right there to see where can you find freedom. May all beings be truly free.
Are we sitting next week? Wednesday.
Thanks, everybody. And being patient. We are coming. No, yeah, exactly. July 3rd, Ron, see you in a week. And we're going to talk about when to hold them and when to fold them. See you then.
Yeah.